Okay, welcome everybody to today's session of Austrian Economics for Managers. We've been making good progress through a large set of reading materials, and I hope that you're enjoying the readings and that you're getting something out of them. I'll mention the readings briefly as we go, but if you have any specific questions about any of those, don't hesitate to ask us. And you know, this is our next to last meeting of the course. We've talked about business strategy. We've talked about firm boundaries, vertical integration in particular. We're going to talk today about how we organize sort of the hierarchy of the firm, how we assign decision rights or delegate decision authority throughout the firm. And next week, we're going to talk about compensation and motivation. Obviously, that will not cover every potential application of Austrian economic thinking to business organization, to business strategy, to management. But as I said at the beginning of the course, hopefully it will give you a little bit of a taste of how insights from the Austrian tradition might be useful for whatever practical problems that you face. Speaking of practical problems, one issue that I'll mention now for those of you who are here, but we'll also mention it by an email announcement and in the news forum as well, is that for next week, we're going to hold our lecture on a different day than usual. So rather than Thursday at 5:30 Eastern time, we'll be holding the lecture Wednesday at 5:30 Eastern time. So same time, but Wednesday instead of Thursday for next week. And I apologize for any inconvenience, but that is due to a travel conflict. Hopefully, the snowstorm that has hit the Southeast and the Mid-Atlantic states today will not do any further damage to my travel plans or anybody else's travel plans. But you know, that's what we that's the price we pay for being in an age of global warming, right? That it gets really cold and there's a lot of snow. Okay, so today's topic, as I mentioned before, has to do with the first part of organizational design, namely how we allocate decision rights. And, you know, decision rights, sort of a fancy word, right? But a decision right is simply a sort of legal assignment or entitlement for a person to make a certain decision. Right, so if I within the Mises Academy program, if I have the ability to choose what articles I want students to read, and to choose what, you know, how I want to organize my lectures and so forth, we would say that, you know, I have a fair amount of autonomy as an employee in the system. We could imagine another kind of educational program in which the director, or for a university, the dean or the department head has much more strict control, right? Where topics, not only are topics assigned to instructors, but instructors are told what readings to use, what books and articles to assign, what topics, what specific subtopics to cover on any particular day. I worked at a university once where the final exams were standardized across courses in a particular subject. So instructors were not allowed to write and grade their own final exams, but someone external to the course was responsible for that. You know, one of the lessons in studying organizational design, as with other aspects of management, is that, you know, every possible arrangement, every possible allocation of decision rights in this context has pros and cons, right? There are strengths and weaknesses of any possible allocation of decision rights. And, you know, no theory, whether it's Austrian economics or any other kind of economics or sociology or whatever, can tell you, you know, the following is the perfect or most efficient or optimal way to assign decision rights for any firm in any situation. Right? No. Rather, what Austrian economics and other analytical frameworks can do is, you know, help us kind of formalize the problem and think through the problem and analyze various trade-offs so that we can apply that framework to the specific details of the problem at hand. And that's exactly what we're going to do today in our discussion of decision rights. So let me start with a little bit of sort of background and context, or just sort of laying out some basic definitions and directions for analysis. Right? Think about the decision rights problem as having multiple components. Right? One component involves tasks, specific functions or activities that need to be performed within the organization. So one question is, you know, which tasks should be performed and which individuals should perform which tasks? Right now, once we have a particular set of tasks identified, we might also ask which individuals will perform which jobs. In other words, how should specific tasks be bundled into particular jobs that are filled by particular individuals, right? You know, so as in the picture here, you know, attaching rivets to a piece of steel, moving particular pieces of steel into place, testing the strength of the assembly and so forth, those are all different tasks. Should the same person perform each task, or should different individuals be highly specialized to particular tasks? Right, so if we look at an individual as the unit of analysis, an individual authority, we could ask first, should the individual be assigned a large variety of tasks or a smaller variety of tasks? In other words, should jobs be highly specialized? You do one thing and you do it well. Or should jobs be more diversified? You do a number of different tasks related to a job. We can also ask whether, for a given scope of a job, whether the individual worker should have a lot of authority to make his or her own decisions, or whether authority should be circumscribed from above. Imagine these two dimensions. You know, imagine laying them out on a diagram, a two-dimensional diagram like the one that you see here. Right. So in this diagram, the vertical axis represents task specialization, right? So how are jobs assigned to workers highly specialized, or is an employee given a broader variety of tasks? The horizontal dimension represents the depth of decision authority given to any particular employee. It could be very narrow, where the employee is basically told what to do, or it can be very broad, where the employee has a lot of discretion. And you can imagine different kind of ideal type jobs in Max Weber's sense of an ideal type, right, fitting in different places in this diagram, right? So, you know, area one, the lower left-hand part of the diagram, that might be, say, an assembly line worker in a very hierarchically structured firm, you know, assembling automobiles, for example. And your job is to attach part A to part B, right? That's all you do over and over again throughout the day. And you don't have much latitude in how to assemble, how to attach part A to part B. There's a standard way it's done in this organization. You've been trained to do it that way, and you do it that way and that way alone. Something like area two, right, in the northwest quadrant of this diagram, you know, that might be a job like an administrative assistant, you know, or a receptionist in a small office. Right, the receptionist has a number of different jobs to perform, answering the phone, handling correspondence, filing documents, greeting visitors when they come in, you know, maybe making the coffee, right? But that receptionist does not have a whole lot of latitude, a lot of authority in how to do the job. You know, he or she is told by the boss, hey, you're going to do these 10 things. This is how we want them done. Now go do them. We can imagine other jobs in which the employee has a fairly narrowly defined job but has a lot of latitude in how to perform the job, right? Like area three in the diagram. Take a job in sales, for example. Let's say that you're selling fertilizer to farmers in a rural area. And maybe you're allowed to use whatever techniques you think will work, right? So you have a narrowly defined job, sell fertilizer. But how you sell the fertilizer, well, you can kind of make that up as you go along, depending on your experiences, depending on what you've learned from others and so forth. We're not going to tell you what technique to use to sell to a particular farmer, but we're going to tell you that your job is to sell to farmers. Right? So, of course, something in the northeast quadrant, area four, that would be more like a mid-level management job or a general managerial or executive position. you have a number of different tasks to perform, and you have a lot of authority, a lot of latitude to determine how these tasks should be performed. Right now, one of the sort of stylized facts about modern business organization is that, you know, we don't have as many tasks in area, as many jobs in Area 1 as we used to. Right, the old kind of traditional factory, management practices associated with people like F.W. Taylor, right, where we have a lot of factory drones who have one thing to do, and they're supposed to do that one thing and do only that. You know, we still have some of those jobs in the modern knowledge-based economy, but not as many of them, right? It's like most jobs are moving, even in factories, away from sort of Area 1 and in the general direction of Area 4, right? More to the north and more to the east in this diagram, even in even on assembly lines, you know, the Toyota production system, as opposed to the old automobile system of the 1950s, 60s, 70s, right, where employees have a lot more latitude and are given more responsibility for doing different things. I mean, this is one of the reasons, supposedly, that the American automobile industry fell on hard times in the 1980s and 1990s as Japanese imports began to flood into the U.S. and also into Europe, right? I mean, part of the reason why Toyota and Honda and Nissan and Mazda, and now the Korean companies and so forth, began to sell so many more cars in the U.S. and in Europe, sorry, I should say in North America and in Europe, was not only because tariff restrictions were relaxed, some quotas were relaxed a little bit. I mean, that's part of the story. But the other part of the story is there was huge demand for these cars, right? Not only were they more fuel efficient, but they were better made. The quality of the assembly was higher. They were perceived by the consumer to be higher quality than the domestic alternatives, right? That's not the case in the 60s and 70s when Japanese cars first came into North America and Europe. They were sort of low-end vehicles, but they became perceived as having a higher build quality than the North American vehicles and some of the European vehicles. And part of that allegedly had to do with the way jobs were designed, right? In the old American system, if an assembly line worker thought that, you know, part A and part B really weren't fitting together very well, there wasn't anything that employee could do, right? He had to wait till the next break, and then he could go petition a supervisor who would then have to ask his supervisor and so forth, and it might be days or weeks or months before anything was done about it, as opposed to the Toyota kind of system, the Japanese model, where, you know, any assembly line worker, even at the very bottom of the pyramid, you know, had a red button nearby that he could push. And once that red button were pushed, you know, production would come to a halt, people would come over, small groups of workers would gather around and look at the problem and try to come up with a solution, right? Much more decentralized form of organization. That has a lot of advantages, right? And that's part of the reason, according to the conventional story, why you know, the old Taylorite sort of factory is not with us anymore, why we don't see so many jobs in quadrant one. We see them more in 2, 3, and 4, especially moving more towards 4. So how can we explain that, right? What lies behind that? Well, let me go over a few basic concepts before we go into sort of our analysis of what's going on. First basic concept, and one that we've talked about before, is the distinction between what Jensen and Meckling, in the reading for this week, term specific knowledge and general knowledge. If you've read Hayek, you're already familiar with this notion of specific knowledge, although Hayek doesn't use that term, right? What Jensen and Meckling, drawing on Hayek and people like Michael Polanyi, what they mean by general knowledge is knowledge that is fairly easy to communicate from one person to another, right? So what is the weather forecast for Boston for tomorrow? I may not have that information at my fingertips, but I can pretty easily find it out. I can go to the web. I can go to the weather app on my phone. I can ask a friend. I can quickly, easily find out, right, even if I don't know. You know, who won the Laker game last night? How is it going in the Olympics? Is Norway still beating everybody else in the medal count? I mean, I can easily find that out even if I don't currently know it. it's the cost of transferring that information or knowledge is fairly low. That's different from what Jensen and Meckling call specific knowledge, right? Specific knowledge is knowledge that is difficult or costly to communicate from one person to another. If I don't presently have that knowledge, but I feel like I need it, it's difficult for me to get it. Specific knowledge can take different forms, right? It could be scientific knowledge, right? Knowledge associated with theoretical physics or something, right? If I want to understand, let's say I don't know anything about black holes. In fact, I don't know anything about black holes except what I've seen in, sci-fi movies. In principle, I could go to the university library, or I could go to some academic websites, and I could download the latest books and articles in cosmology and theoretical physics and quantum mechanics or whatever it might be, and I could attempt to read them. My eyes could sort of follow along with the words. I guess it would mostly be math and not words, right? But I wouldn't actually understand anything that I'm reading unless I have advanced training in theoretical physics or whatever the relevant disciplines are, right? So scientific knowledge is not generally accessible to people without advanced scientific training. So it would be very difficult for me to get a deep understanding of black holes in a reasonable amount of time. Specific knowledge, or knowledge can also be specific because it's idiosyncratic, meaning, it's just not worth, nobody's bothered to write it down, nobody has bothered to encapsulate it or articulate it in a way that it could easily be acquired by somebody who doesn't have it. And those of you who have read Hayek's famous article, The Use of Knowledge in Society from 1945, will recognize this as what Hayek described as sort of, knowledge of the specific circumstances of time and place. Suppose you want to know, what did Peter Klein have for breakfast on the 13th of February 2014? Probably it would be difficult for you to get that information because, where would you go to look it up? It's not important enough to be written down. You could call me or you could email me and try to find out. Maybe if I'm a compulsive Instagram user, I took a picture of my breakfast and I posted it on Instagram. I'm not, by the way. Maybe you could find out that way. But in general, there are a lot of sort of mundane details of everyday life and of business organization that people don't know, right? The people who are there, the man on the spot in Hayek's terminology, has that idiosyncratic knowledge, but a central planner does not. The executive of the company does not. Your friend or relative who lives thousands of miles away does not have that information. So it's costly to transfer or difficult to transfer in that sense. The final category is what Jensen and Meckling call assembled knowledge, or what Hayek would call tacit knowledge. Right? By tacit, Hayek means knowledge that is not easy to articulate. It's like you have it in your head, but you can't easily write it down in a formula. I like to think of the example of riding a bicycle, right? If you know how to ride a bicycle, then the knowledge of how to operate a bike is in your mind, right? It's somewhere up there in your brain, but it's something that you could not easily articulate in words or numbers. Again, imagine that you have a friend who is thousands of miles away, and you communicate with this friend via social media, but not in person, right? And this friend has never ridden a bicycle before, and you're going to write down a series of steps and put them in an email or a Facebook message for your friend thousands of miles away, such that they could read through this series of steps and they could ride a bike. Is that going to work? No, of course not. You write it down to the best of your ability, and you send it to your friend, and they read it on their smartphone. Oh, okay, step one, stand next to the bicycle and put your hands on the handlebars. Let's see if I can act this out, right? Step two, put your leg over and put your feet on the pedals, and step three, start turning the pedals, and off you go. What do you imagine would happen if your friend reads those instructions and tries it, right? They're going to go, poof, the bicycle just lands, you know, on its side, right? Because, as you know, if you know how to ride a bike, there are all kinds of subtleties associated with operating a bicycle. You know, how to shift your weight, you know, how hard you can turn the wheel without falling over, how fast you need to be pedaling, and so forth. There are all kinds of, you know, these sort of tacit details that if you know how to ride a bike, you must, you know, that information is in your head, but it's not in your head in a form in which you can easily articulate it in words or numbers that you could communicate to somebody else, right? In other words, as we all know, and if you have small children in your household, you know, the only way somebody can learn how to ride a bike is by practicing. You have to just get out there and do it. And no matter how much your teacher or instructor coaches you, that coaching is no substitute for the experience of trying it and falling down several times and eventually figuring it out. Right? So the knowledge is assembled in the sense that you acquire it through experience. Right? I mean, maybe a more relevant example, you know, for our context would be, again, go back to that salesman or salesperson that I mentioned before. Say that you're, you know, you got a young person fresh out of college with a degree in marketing from a, you know, good university who's going to go out and sell fertilizer. And imagine that there is, you know, an experienced salesperson who has been working that territory for years and is planning to retire and hand it over to this you know, brand new, this rookie who's just fresh out of school. I mean, the experienced salesperson could say, okay, hey, I'm going to take you out a few times with me on my route. I'm going to introduce you to my customers. And, you know, maybe this experienced salesperson has taken notes and has a little black book with some details. You know, Farmer Brown, he likes this, and he usually buys under these circumstances, and this is his wife's birthday, and here are the names of his kids, and his favorite pig is named Freddy, or whatever. Yeah, I mean, maybe the experienced salesperson can hand that little black book over to the rookie, but the rookie is not going to be as good at selling, not right away, right? Because the experienced salesperson has all kinds of knowledge, tacit knowledge, knowledge assembled over time in his or her head that simply cannot be written down in a black book and given to the rookie. The only way the rookie is going to be as good as the experienced salesperson is by trying it out and doing it over a period of time and learning his or her own special tricks and new techniques and so forth. Okay, what's the point? Well, the point is, if all the relevant knowledge were general, if all of the knowledge necessary to operate a business, all of the knowledge necessary to allocate resources and so forth, if all of that knowledge were general, then you could have a very centralized kind of organization. At the level of the entire economy, we could have top-down central planning, right? Everybody in the economy just communicates their knowledge to the central planner, and the central planner plugs it into a computer and tells everybody what to do, and off we go, right? As many of you recognize, you know, this is Hayek's argument against central planning. It's a little bit different from Mises' argument, right? Hayek says, no, that wouldn't work, because even if people were willing to serve the central planner, a lot of the knowledge that they need, a lot of the knowledge that is necessary to make good economic decisions is tacit, right? It's not possible for us to communicate it to the central planner even if we want to, right? In an organizational context, a lot of the knowledge necessary for the best way to attach part A to part B on that assembly line may be tacit knowledge, right? Such that the only one who really knows how to do it is the assembly line worker who's been doing it for years. And you don't want a highly centralized form of organization in which a manager or a supervisor or a CEO tells the assembly line worker exactly what to do. That, you know, that could work fine if all of the relevant knowledge were general and can be written down in a book or posted on a website. If some of that knowledge is specific, then you might want to allow the people who already have the specific knowledge to make the decisions. We'll elaborate on that conclusion in just a moment. But first, let me remind you of two other key concepts that are relevant to this discussion. One is the notion of authority. Right, and here I'm drawing on a very famous social scientist Herbert Simon, who articulated these different types of authority in his book on administrative behavior. Most people think of authority as, an authority figure is somebody who bosses you around, a parent, a teacher, a supervisor, whatever. But Simon usefully pointed out that we can distinguish among two different types of authority, what he called type one and type two. Right, type one authority is where the principal, right, commands to an agent a specific action ex post. In other words, the principal says to the agent, you will do this. That's what most of us think of authority as being, right? As opposed to type two authority, which is where the principal decides what things the agent himself or herself can decide, and which things the agent is allowed to decide on their own, right? So in authority of type two is not telling people what to do. It's deciding what decisions people should be allowed to make on their own. Again, for those of you who are parents, and I guess all of us were children at some point, right? You can think of parenting in this sense. I mean, when your children are very small, you as a parent exercise a lot of type one authority. Don't put that in your mouth. You must go to bed and take a nap right now. This is what you're going to wear, and I'm going to put it on you. As your children get older, parenting becomes less about type one authority, but more about type two authority. I mean, under what circumstances will I allow my kid to make their own meal choices, right? At what point, if your kids get older, you have teenagers, right? So under what circumstances do they have to get your permission before they go out and do X, Y, Z? Do you allow them to go to a party without telling you where they are and when they'll be home, right? So again, as the kids get older, the art of parenting is knowing what to delegate and what not to delegate, right? And the act of choosing to delegate or not to delegate is itself an exercise of authority. So my point is, authority does not always mean telling people exactly what to do. And so we often think, well, hierarchical forms of organization are bad because they involve the boss telling the worker what to do. And because of the knowledge problem we've already discussed, you want workers to make their own decisions about what to do. I mean, that may be true in a particular case, but you still need someone to decide, well, who the employees will be, right? Why is this person an employee and not that person? And what is the scope of discretion within which an employee can exercise, can make his or her own decisions? On what matters do we allow the employee to make a decision? On what matters do we not? In other words, that assembly line worker we've been talking about may be entitled to decide how best to attach part A to part B, and the supervisor is not going to get involved in that discussion. But the supervisor is going to say, you can't sell the company to a rival firm, right? There are certain things that assembly worker cannot do, no matter how much authority they have over attaching part A to part B. So third concept is this notion of alienability, right? That's a legal term. Alienability refers to the extent to which decision authority can be transferred. Okay, so in sort of contracting between individuals, right, or between firms, right, you can buy and sell decision authority by buying and selling assets, right? So, if I own a smartphone, right, if I'm the owner of the smartphone, I can decide how it's going to be used and so forth. I can transfer the decision authority over how to use the phone to Danny Sanchez by selling him the phone, right? So then he pays me a sum of money, he becomes the owner of the phone, and now he has the authority to use the phone as he sees fit, right? Within an organization, all decision rights are not alienable in that sense, right? As I said, the assembly line worker, maybe he has the authority to attach part A to part B, but he does not have the authority to bring in somebody from the outside who's going to attach part A to part B, right? Unless that employee has some HR responsibility, right? I may say to that employee, I'm going to hire you and not somebody else, and you can decide on these things, but you cannot decide who else is going to work in this company and who's not. You don't have that particular decision right. And if you don't, then there are limits to what that employee can do. Right, so if we want to think of decision rights in an organization as being analogous to property rights, we have to remember that the analogy only goes so far. Right? So the assembly line worker, he may have control over his machine. I may say, you decide how to operate the machine, how fast to run the machine, when to maintain the machine, you know, how often to clean the machine, and so forth. But you don't have full property rights over this machine. You can't sell it to somebody else. You can't put the machine up on eBay because I own the machine and not you. In other words, decision rights in an organization are analogous to property rights, but the analogy only goes so far. It's not a perfect analogy, right? Because with real property right ownership over something like this phone, you have the right to give it away or sell it. If you are assigned decision authority within an organization as an employee, you do not typically have the authority to transfer your decision rights or to sell your decision rights to somebody else. Okay, so now we have everything we need to talk about, you know, whether a firm should be decentralized, how decentralized a firm should be, how far should decentralization go, and so forth. So if you were to ask me, hey, Peter, within my company, should we be decentralized? Or you could put it in terms of marginal changes. You might say, well, this is the way my company operates now. Should we decentralize a little bit more? Right? Should I assign a few more decision rights to my subordinates? Or should I, you know, assign a few less? Should I grab a little bit more control, exercise a little bit more control myself? You know, and I would never give you a yes or no answer, right? I would say, well, the answer is it depends, right? It depends on the circumstances in your particular context. In other words, what I mean is I can't tell you how decentralized you should be, but I can tell you here are some benefits of being decentralized. And on the other hand, here are some costs of being decentralized. And it's up to you as the man or woman on the spot to weigh these benefits and costs at the margin and decide what you ought to do in your particular case, right? So, well, you know, if we were just to compile a list, what are some of the benefits of decentralized decision-making in organizations? Well, the most obvious one is the one we've already discussed, making more effective use of specific knowledge, right? The term that Jensen and Meckling use is co-location. In other words, they say that because a lot of knowledge in an organization is specific, rather than trying to transfer that knowledge to a decision maker at the top who then gives orders down the line, right, it makes sense to co-locate the decision right and the specific knowledge. In other words, if an individual within an organization has the specific knowledge necessary to make that part of the organization work, you should assign the decision right to that individual. If knowledge cannot be easily transferred within an organization, then let the knowledge stay where it is and transfer the decision right. Right? That's one that if you can't put the knowledge in the hand of the person who already has the decision right, then put the decision right in the hands of the person who already has the knowledge. That's this notion of co-location of authority and knowledge. We'll look at the funky graph that they use in just a moment to illustrate that concept. But we can elaborate some other benefits of decentralization, which are not emphasized by Jensen and Meckling. Conservation of senior managers' time, right? I mean, there's an opportunity cost to managers having to make a lot of decisions. If you delegate operational responsibility to those at lower levels of the corporate hierarchy, you free up those at the higher levels, you know, to focus on long-range strategic planning and personnel decisions and, you know, how to design incentive schemes and so forth without making them responsible for the nuts and bolts of day-to-day operations. You might also think of kind of a training and motivational angle, right? If a firm, if an organization wants to sort of grow and nurture talent from within, if you want to be able to promote from inside the firm, then if you've got a highly centralized structure where most decision authority is held by people at the top, then people at lower levels of the organization, they don't have any practice, they don't have any training, any experience in how to make decisions. It's very unlikely that you will find a good, you know, lower level manager from the pool of assembly line workers if the assembly line workers have no experience in making decisions. And likewise, you're unlikely to get a good middle manager or a senior manager out of the pool of lower level managers if they don't have much managerial experience, right? So delegation can be a good way of sort of motivating or empowering employees to develop the skills that are necessary to become good managers themselves. You know, we could probably enumerate other benefits of decentralization as well, and please suggest some in the chat room as you think of them, right? But, you know, does it follow from that that all firms should be as decentralized as possible all the time? Well, no, because that's only half of the equation, right? Besides these benefits, there are a number of costs of decentralized decision making. What mainstream economists might call agency costs, referring to the so-called principal-agent problem, meaning costs associated with employees not doing what supervisors want, right? So, you know, shirking on the job. Let's not be naive, right? If we give the assembly line worker the authority to decide how part A will be attached to part B, the authority of how to operate his or her machine, when the machine should be serviced, and so forth, because this worker is not the residual claimant, this worker doesn't actually own the machine and doesn't bear the full costs of his or her decisions, the worker may slack off, right? Shirking could be a problem. The worker may, in fact, be goofing off when it looks like inspecting the machine. And the worker may say, you know, really, trying to produce, 500 of these things a day, that's running our assembly line too fast. We really ought to slow it down to 150. I mean, it may be because that really is the best way to produce high-quality widgets off this assembly line, but it may also be that the employee is lazy. I mean, it's easier to operate at a lower speed, and the employee wants to operate at a lower speed just because that makes the job easier, even though it isn't in the interest of the principal or it isn't in the interest of the organization as a whole. You know, in saying that, am I disparaging the integrity of workers on an assembly line? Of course not. This applies to anybody within the organization, right? I mean, it may be that the board of directors has allocated a lot of decision authority to the CEO, and the CEO is really more concerned with grooming himself or herself for, you know, their next position. Maybe the CEO has a lot of vanity and really wants to be on magazine covers and wants to be interviewed and wants to get paid more and so forth, but really isn't all that concerned with running the company in the best possible way. I mean, every time a board of directors fires a CEO, which happens very often, it's because of some sort of agency costs, right? The CEO is not doing what the board of directors wants. The CEO is shirking, if we want to use that term, and has to be replaced with some other CEO, right? So anytime one party delegates a decision authority to another party, that second party may use that decision right in a way that goes against the interests of the first party. Okay, and the first party takes that into account and may decide it's not worth it to delegate because the costs associated with the agency problem are too high, right? There might also be sort of, you know, coordination problems. This worker is attaching A to B, but then you know, that thing goes on to the next stage in the assembly line where somebody else has to attach part C, right? And maybe, you know, how A and B are attached to each other has an effect on how easily you can attach part C to it. And so if we allow the worker, assembly line worker, to have a lot of autonomy over attaching A and B, that may make it harder for attaching C. So we may lose some overall coordination by delegating too much authority, right? That's a cost of delegation. You may lose some coordination. Again, remember, in the free market, that kind of coordination is accomplished between individuals and between firms through the price mechanism, right? So just as, the concept Austrians call spontaneous order, Bastiat's famous quip that Paris gets fed, meaning even without a central planner deciding, you know, what kind of bread Parisians should eat and how much and which kind of food should be available in which shop and so forth, you know, through the coordination of the market, free markets, private property, the price mechanism and so forth, that coordination takes place without any central direction. I mean, that may or may not apply within an organization. I mean, you don't have full, complete markets within an organization, because then it wouldn't be an organization. It would just actually be market coordination among firms, right? The fact that we're talking about an organization means there is some combined ownership. There are shareholders or partners or proprietors who own all the stuff. So, you know, you can sort of simulate a market within the firm, but it's not actually a market, right? So there may be some need for central coordination, and that central coordination is made more difficult, right, when you have a lot of decentralization. So agency costs and coordination problems, this is what Jensen and Meckling call the costs of inconsistent objectives. And I'm sorry, I see now there's a typo on my slide. I have the word if. It should be of, right? The costs of inconsistent objectives. And, you know, moreover, there may be some central information that is also tacit, right, and difficult to communicate, that the boss has but the workers don't have. And, you know, there's something about the overall corporate strategy. You know, there may be a reason why we have to attach A to B differently, because of something our competitors are doing, because of some technological shock coming down the horizon, because of something that's going on in the C-suite. You know, the assembly line workers don't know that. It's not easy to communicate that to them. They don't need to know it. So rather than try to explain it to them, it's better just to boss them around. You know, again, not to do too much, you know, talk in cliches, but that's sort of the cliche of the army, right? The reason that fighting units are organized into subunits with a chain of command, you know, because in the heat of battle, the battlefield commander doesn't have time to explain to every private, okay, you know, the reason I want you to march over here and try to take this hill is because of this or that. And now let me explain to the next guy why he should also follow you and move in that direction. No, I mean, you don't have time in the heat of battle. The soldiers are supposed to obey orders, and they're not supposed to ask why they're being told to do something. They're just supposed to do it. You know, again, that's a stereotype. It's a cliche. There may be a lot of reasons why you don't want an army to be organized that way. But the kind of ideal type hierarchical fighting force is organized the way that it's organized because the benefits, the costs of decentralization are too high. Because the commander, the battlefield commander, he has knowledge of the overall strategy of engagement that the private holding his gun doesn't have and can't possibly possess and doesn't need to have. Okay. So what's the point of engaging in this kind of analysis? I guess to say, to go back to the question, you know, should my firm be decentralized? Or given where I already am, should my firm be more decentralized than it currently is? Well, it depends on the relative strength of these costs and benefits, depending on your industry, depending on your personnel, depending on the capabilities of top management, depending on the capabilities and training of lower-level employees, right? The decision makers have to sort of weigh these benefits and costs at the margin and decide what to do. So that's, you know, look at Jensen and Meckling's funky diagram, right? It's a little bit weird. I wouldn't have drawn it this way, but you know, all they're doing is they're trying to measure benefits and costs on the vertical axis, and so on they're trying to measure organizational structure on the horizontal axis, and they have an axis measuring the, you know, the extent of delegation or the degree of decentralization, right? They call it, you know, distance of the decision rights from the CEO's office. So what they mean is a firm that's organized, you know, has the form of organization to the left of the horizontal axis, in one in which the CEO holds, you know, most of the decision rights. At the extreme, the origin there, the CEO holds all the decision rights, right? But as you move to the right in their diagram, you have people who are far from the CEO having, you know, more and more decision rights, right? So the distance of decision right from the CEO's office, as that distance increases, that's their way of parameterizing classifying or capturing the notion of delegation or decentralization. And, you know, they have two curves, right? So the curve that starts at the lower left and sort of curves up, the costs owing to inconsistent objectives, right? Those are, those are costs of decentralization, agency costs, coordination costs. And those costs are modeled as increasing with the degree of decentralization. The more the firm decentralized, the greater the possible costs owing to inconsistent objectives. But you have this other curve, the one that starts at the top left and goes sort of down to the right, what they call the costs owing to poor information, right? That's really the benefits of decentralization. That's the cost of centralized decision making, right? So as you delegate more authority, as you decentralize more, the costs owing to sort of the wrong mismatch between a decision authority and specific knowledge gets smaller, right? The cost of poor information gets smaller as you decentralize more, as you move to the right, because now you're co-locating decision authority and specific knowledge. So that curve is falling as you go to the right. And their point is, if you sort of do a vertical summation of these two cost curves, you get a U-shaped curve, right? If you're not used to looking at these diagrams or you don't like these kind of diagrams, the point is simply to show that the optimum degree of decentralization is neither at the far left of the diagram, nor is it at the far right of the diagram. Rather, it's somewhere in the middle, right? There are benefits associated with decentralization. There are costs associated with decentralization. And if you weigh those benefits and costs at the margin, you're going to find an optimum that is neither fully centralized nor fully decentralized. I mean, there's a much simpler way to draw the diagram. The way I would have drawn it, and the way I draw it in my own teaching, is just something like this, right? Just think of it as a marginal cost curve and a marginal benefit curve. So again, if you measure costs and benefits somehow in some units on the vertical axis, and you measure the degree of decentralization on the horizontal axis, you could say that, well, there are certain benefits associated with decentralization, and those marginal benefits are decreasing in the degree of decentralization. So the benefits are increasing at a decreasing rate, right? But the marginal costs of decentralization, which we already discussed, are increasing, meaning the cost of decentralization is increasing at an increasing rate. You know, if you have a downward sloping marginal benefit curve and an upward sloping marginal cost curve, the optimum is where they cross, right? So D star here is the level of decentralization at which the marginal benefit of decentralizing a little bit more is exactly equal to the marginal cost of decentralizing a little bit more. This is just another way of saying that if you weigh benefits and costs at the margin, you're going to find the best organizational structure is somewhere in the middle. Right now, you shouldn't take these diagrams too literally. I mean, it's not obvious what the units would be. I mean, what's one unit of D and one more unit of D? I mean, that's kind of abstract. How you measure costs and benefits might also be abstract. It might be subjective, as well as measured in monetary terms. So I don't want you to take this diagram too literally. I mean, it's just sort of a heuristic device for illustrating the point that the optimal degree of decentralization varies with the circumstances. And for any given firm, there may be some external changes to the environment that would affect things, right? There may be some technological breakthrough that makes the benefits of decentralization even stronger than they were before. You know, all of a sudden we have increased global competition or more rapid technological change. We need to be able to react more quickly. We need decisions to be made faster without having to be processed by the central administration. So that might mean the benefits of decentralization are greater than they were before. So it's like you shift that marginal benefit curve to the right, and the optimal degree of decentralization increases, right? There may be something else which increases the costs of decentralization, personnel changes, changes in the environment that might make that marginal cost curve shift up, such that we decide we want to decentralize less than we did before, right? So it's always about weighing the benefits and costs. I mean, I like the example from the article by Ralph Steyer, right? It's a case study of the Johnsonville Sausage Company. Those of you living outside the U.S., if you haven't been able to taste these delicious sausages, you know, you're missing out. I mean, they're really good. Italian sausage and bratwurst and all kinds of different cured meats. They're really, really good. And Johnsonville is an example of a firm that went through a rapid organizational change, right? And you can look through the way Ralph Steyer describes things in his own language. I mean, he's not a professor or a business school student. He's using sort of ordinary language to, you know, say that he thought performance was poor. And by making the organization flatter, by delegating, by decentralizing further, he got all these additional benefits: more satisfied employees, higher quality output, a better promotion path, and so forth. I mean, sort of an extreme case, right? He talks about, you know, trying to manage himself out of a job to design an organizational structure in which you don't need a CEO. Okay, I mean, that in fact is, I mean, if you do that, well, I mean, that's part of being a CEO, is deciding what the CEO should do, right? One of the reasons I like to use this example is precisely because it's not from the tech sector. Everybody wants to talk about the tech sector and you know, is Google a flatter organization than, you know, General Motors or something? I mean, that's fine. And it's worth talking about lots of different sectors. But notice, even in an industry that is not considered to be particularly high tech, though food processing does involve a lot of technology, right? Even in an industry that is not sexy and it's not a new economy thing. I mean, we've been making sausage for hundreds of years, right? It's a very old economy kind of business, but yet these principles, benefits and costs of decentralization, apply to that industry just as much as they apply to some other one. Okay, let me speak briefly about some, you know, sort of recent things going on in the economy. I mean, everybody talks about the new economy or the knowledge economy or the information economy or the networked economy or the sharing economy. There are all these sort of, you know, sort of buzzwords, some of which are useful, I guess. But, you know, there's kind of a popular belief, a commonly held belief among business people and students and scholars and policymakers that, you know, because of the internet and because of, you know, computers and so forth, that, you know, we really don't need any kind of hierarchies, right? That everything is becoming completely flat. In other words, decentralization is the thing. Everybody needs to be decentralized as much as possible. You even hear people in this literature talk about Hayek, even those who are not interested in Austrian economics. Just as an aside, some of you may know that the founder of Wikipedia, a guy named Jimmy Wales, he was a student at Auburn University, and he at a libertarian club meeting, he met Mark Thornton, who was teaching a course at Auburn University. Mark is associated with Auburn and is also a senior fellow at the Mises Institute. And from Mark Thornton, Jimmy Wales learned about Hayek. He read Hayek's Use of Knowledge in Society. And he was very directly motivated by Austrian economic theory in coming up with the design of Wikipedia, right? And Jimmy Wales thought that, you know, the Encyclopedia Britannica was going about it the wrong way because of tacit knowledge and delegation and so forth. You ought to have a very decentralized kind of encyclopedia. And, you know, Wikipedia was born. So Wikipedia is directly inspired by Austrian economics, Hayek's work in particular. So if it's true that in our modern knowledge-based economy, you know, tacit knowledge that's highly dispersed or distributed throughout the system is more important than it was before, you know, knowledge is more valuable than it was before, hard assets aren't important, soft assets, knowledge-based assets are important. We have to do things faster. Products have to come on the market quickly, and they diffuse rapidly. Some of you are familiar, especially in the technology business, with the concept of modularity, that different pieces need to sort of work together with other pieces of a system. We have more modular systems that are more flexible than we did before, both on the production side and in the organization side. Therefore, we don't need big hierarchical firms. We talked about this book, Wikonomics, last week in the context of vertical integration. So the authors of that book, Wikonomics, argue that the modern firm, the Wikified firm, not only should be small and not vertically integrated, it should also be very flat, right? So the Wikified firm is one in which you don't have any bosses. It's very egalitarian. Everything's organized. All relationships are horizontal, and everybody can sort of do their own thing without a boss. Going along with this notion is the idea that, again, that the most important assets are the soft ones, the wet assets, especially the knowledge that is in employees' minds, right? So this notion that I discussed before of, the firm, the organization, the company, the corporation owning the machines, owning all the valuable assets. Some people say that's kind of outmoded because the valuable asset nowadays is knowledge, and knowledge is owned by workers. Knowledge is in employees' minds. It's in their heads, and they own their own bodies, so they own the knowledge. So the firm really doesn't own the valuable knowledge anymore. Therefore, very flat organizations with high-powered incentives, pay for performance, piece rate schemes, very strong bonus schemes, and so forth. That is the model that companies should use. My reaction to those kinds of claims is that, there is a lot of truth to them, but these claims are radically overstated. Yes, of course it is true that because of the internet, many of the costs of coordinating have gone down, right? It's much easier for people to obtain information that they need. It is possible to delegate and to coordinate among decentralized decision makers at a lower cost than was possible before. So to go back to our framework and our diagram from before, thanks to the internet, thanks to modern technology, it's probably the case that the benefits of decentralization are greater than they were before. But as we also saw, in the context of firm boundaries with the Varian article from last week, some of the costs of decentralization may also have gone up, right? Or to put it another way, some of the costs of hierarchical organization have also gone down, right? You can monitor employees more easily than you did before. You can affect coordination more effectively than you could before. Managers, employers, bosses can obtain information about employees more easily than they could before. In other words, we've got to look at the benefits and the costs, right, and say that yes, the Wikipedia model has some advantages, but technology has also made hierarchies in some dimensions work better than they did before. Just let's, if we look at the empirical evidence, right? When you hear people like Tapscott and Williams give their Wikonomics speech, they usually point to a number of examples. They say, well, we see more strategic alliances than we did before. We see more joint ventures rather than internally controlled projects than we did before. They say, well, look at Wikipedia. Now, everybody uses Wikipedia instead of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Linux is better than Microsoft Windows. Look at the growth of the Android operating system as an open source platform. Look how many firms are using high-powered incentives. Look how many people are independent contractors instead of employees. I mean, yeah, that's fine, but that's kind of ad hoc evidence. I mean, that's cherry-picking. Right, so every time somebody wants to say, "Oh, look at Android," somebody else can say, "Well, look at Apple, look at iOS." I mean, Apple is has a completely closed ecosystem. You know, Steve Jobs was making the decisions about everything. Just this morning, I read an article on the next revision to Windows. I think they're calling it Windows 8.1 Revision 1 or Service Pack 1 or something like that. And people are complaining that Windows is getting worse and worse because it's sort of designed by committee, right? That there's no strong hand like the hand of Steve Jobs to impose a vision and direct people. You know, you need strong leadership. You have that with iOS. You don't have that with Android. You don't have that with Windows. You know, there are a lot of very successful, large, integrated companies. I mean, Walmart is not organized on the Wikipedia model. General Electric is not organized on the Wikipedia model. A lot of successful companies are hierarchical. You know, just as we saw last week with the Variant article, technology affects different firms in different ways. Likewise, it is not the case that the decentralized model is always better in all circumstances, even with the advent of networks and sharing and, you know, high-powered computing and so forth. There are a few academic studies. A good one is by Rajan and Wolf in the Review of Economics and Statistics, 2006. I think the title of the paper is "The Flattening Hierarchy?" And their conclusion is, if you look at larger data sets, look more comprehensively across industries and across types of firms, there's not very much evidence of the flattening hierarchy. They look at some measures. They look at one particular survey of U.S. companies and claim that there's an increase in breadth of authority. So you have, on average, more managers reporting to the CEO. So, you know, greater horizontal depth below the C-suite. Increase in breadth, right? But a decrease in depth, meaning fewer levels of management between the heads of operating divisions and the CEOs. So that's a little bit of evidence of flattening, but not very much. They're finding some flattening and some widening, but the effects are pretty small. They find some increase in, you know, stock options and other ownership incentives among senior managers. This is sort of the best systematic empirical evidence we have, and it's very modest. Right? So there is some evidence for a little bit of flattening, but on many other dimensions, the CEO is playing an even stronger role than the CEO did before. So again, it may be true that there is some wiki stuff going on in the world, you know, in the business world at large, but we really can't say for sure. The market has not chosen decentralization everywhere and always. We want to have plenty of time for questions. I have some sort of further remarks on authority, which were already mentioned briefly last week, so I'm going to go on to say a few words about innovation specifically, and then a little bit about agency costs and sort of task specialization. So, everything that we've talked about so far, you know, benefits and costs of decentralization in terms of sort of, you know, firm performance, profitability, productivity, firm value, I mean, a lot of those things also apply if what we're interested in is not so much how well the firm is performing now, but how much the firm is innovating, and therefore how likely the firm will perform well in the future, right? So everything that we've talked about applies to innovation as well. But it's worth making a few specific remarks about delegation of authority or decentralization, or more generally, organizational structure and innovation. I mean, it goes without saying that knowledge is particularly important for innovation, especially in scientific and technical fields, you know, for IT companies, for biotech firms, for software companies, but really for all industries in the economy, innovation requires a lot of knowledge. So you might think, based on the conversation we've already had, well, decentralization must be particularly valuable for firms wanting to innovate, because surely the personnel with the necessary scientific knowledge, with the necessary technical knowledge, the engineers, the developers, the programmers, right? You know, they're going to have the necessary information. And so you need to give them a lot of latitude, right? You can't have a hierarchically organized research lab out of which a lot of valuable innovation is going to come out, is going to come, right? So that may be true. So let's assume that some degree of delegation, some delegation of authority is going to be necessary, right, to have innovative organizations. But we still have the further question of how we should do it, right? So for individual knowledge workers, for scientific personnel, for engineers, for programmers, and so forth, how do we motivate them to innovate, right? How do we get them to innovate more and to do the right kind of innovation? Well, I mean, we can give them very extrinsic incentives, very explicit incentives, right? So we could say, for example, if you're an engineer at our company and you develop some kind of new process that can be patented or for which we can otherwise somehow generate some revenue off that innovation, we'll let you have the money. We'll let you have some of the money, right? So maybe we'll share any licensing revenues from this patent or from this new innovation with the inventor. Or maybe we'll just have cash bonuses or stock-related bonuses to individuals who are innovative, right? You know, maybe it's not just scientists and engineers. I mean, maybe anybody in an organization who can come up with a new way of doing something, a better way to do something that creates value for the company, we want somehow to reward that employee. We want to give that employee a share of that created, newly created value, again, through a bonus system or through some kind of revenue sharing plan or whatever. It may also be the case that innovative employees are intrinsically motivated. I mean, they want to innovate anyway, we just have to give them an environment in which they can. So most famous example of this, a lot of you are familiar with it, would be the 3M company, right? 3M is a diversified manufacturing company in Minnesota that is, you know, known throughout the world for being highly, highly innovative. The way 3M innovates is with an equally famous model, what they call the 20% rule. Right, so scientific and technical personnel at 3M have a lot of latitude to use company equipment to sort of do their own experiments, right? The 20% rule means that one day out of every five, these scientific personnel, they can use company facilities. They can use the lab to work on their own projects, right? Not projects that were assigned to them by a supervisor, not projects that have any obvious sort of direct commercial potential, but just ideas that they think are cool, right? That they can experiment, they can try new things. Maybe some of it will end up being commercializable. Maybe it won't. Like part of the idea with 3M's model is not only that you might get some really cool stuff coming out of the lab that you can sell and make money from, right? But also that you know, the best and the brightest engineers and scientists, they enjoy getting to experiment. They enjoy having free time in the lab. They enjoy getting to work on pet projects. That's a perk that allows you to attract higher quality scientists and engineers. It gives them higher on-the-job satisfaction. You're more likely to retain them. And they're more likely to be happy about working on projects that they're really not interested in when they get one day of the week to work on whatever the heck they want. You know, Google might be another example. You know, Google has a subunit called Google Labs where they work on all sorts of crazy and funky stuff, right? Very little of which may end up being commercialized, but it's a way of rewarding the nerds who work at Google and motivating the best and the brightest nerds to go there. Another question is, you know, how do we organize our innovative activities, you know, from sort of a structural point of view? Do we set up a separate subsidiary and give it a lot of autonomy and say, okay, we have this, you know, we have this technical problem we need to be solved. We need a new thing in this market, and we're not going to tell you what to do. We're going to put you guys in a room, give you toys to play with, and say, you figure it out. So a highly independent, highly autonomous subsidiary, what people sometimes call a skunk works operation or a skunk work, right? That was the specific term. I think it was Lockheed Martin that first came up with the term skunk work. I think they've actually patented that term or trademarked that term in the mid 20th century. You know, come up with a new jet engine or a new fighter plane, and you know, because we were afraid that being trapped in the corporate hierarchy will stifle you, we're going to give you your own separate little, you know, operation that you can run without supervision, and you know, come back later and show us what you came up with. In the automobile industry, when General Motors established the now defunct subsidiary Saturn in the 1980s, the idea was, oh well, we can't compete with the Japanese, you know, because we're not doing it right. We're doing it the old American way. It's too hard for us to change. So why don't we just set up a little skunk work outfit? Why don't we set up a new autonomous subsidiary? We'll give them our financial backing. We'll let them use our marketing muscle, but we'll let them kind of do it on their own and see if they can come up with a better mousetrap. Unfortunately, they weren't successful in that case. Some large companies set up incubators, right? Just like you have private incubators and university incubators and government incubators that try to help startup companies get going. Maybe you want to set up a corporate incubator that lets little projects get started, right? And so maybe the corporate office is more like a venture capital firm. Rather than tell people what to do, we want to set up little subsidiaries and give them some funding, kind of like venture capital, and you know, let entrepreneurs in our company pitch ventures to the corporate office, and we'll decide which ones to fund, and then we'll sort of steward them and nurture them the way a VC would fund an independent startup. A lot of companies are embracing this model as a way to try to be more innovative. Now, of course, as you could already tell based on what we've discussed earlier tonight, that may bring about some problems, right? These projects may not be well integrated into the rest of the firm. They may not be consistent with the company's overall objectives and overall corporate strategy. There may be problems of coordination, you know, not only among these different innovative units, but you know, with the other elements of the firm, with the marketing division and the design people and the accountants and so forth. You know, you sometimes hear that the skunkworks model is sort of obsolete because you need tighter coordination among different activities within the firm. But you see a lot of kind of hybrid models where there is something that's kind of like a skunkworks, a semi-independent subsidiary or division or project where the marketing guys and the accounting guys play a stronger role than they did in the old Lockheed Martin system, where, of course, then they were selling to the Air Force, and so it was sort of a whole different ballgame anyway. One of the things that comes out of the literature on organizational structure and innovation is that you know, for to get good ideas to bubble up, you know, you really need a so-called project champion, right? Again, it's analogous to being a venture capitalist. If you're a VC, you know, you get lots and lots of pitches every day, and the challenge for the VC is to decide what to fund, to sort the wheat from the chaff. Right, so in a large organization, you have these same problems. There are lots of employees, lots of individuals, lots of engineers who have different ideas for things the company can do. Here's a new project that would make us a lot of money. Here's a way we should restructure this or that. This is going to be really great for us. Which of those do you implement? Right, so senior management has to decide which projects are worth supporting and which aren't. And so from the point of view of the engineer or the inventor or the employee at a lower level of the organization, finding somebody at the top who will champion your project and make sure you get funding and make sure you get the attention of the other divisions and so forth is really, really critical to making this work. Okay, let me stop for today by talking a little bit about the chapter from Foss and Klein that I asked you to read. You know, in my work on entrepreneurship, what I've tried to do is put a little bit of a further spin on this analysis of delegation by, again, thinking about it from the point of view of uncertainty and heterogeneous resources And this notion that entrepreneurship is about organizing heterogeneous resources under conditions of uncertainty. Right? And as I've discussed before, and as I'll emphasize now, critical to this view of the firm and this view of delegation is that ownership is really important. Right? Asking what is a firm and what should be inside the firm and how the firm should be organized. Yeah, these are really questions about the allocation of ownership within an economy. And ownership is tightly connected to this idea of entrepreneurial judgment that comes out of Mises and Frank Knight and other people. Right? So I just want to contrast what some people think of sort of the legal fiction notion of ownership. That, you know, ownership, well, this is really something the lawyers draft documents about, you know, whether we're organized as a partnership or as a proprietorship, whether we go public and have stockholders. I mean, you know, it's sort of an arbitrary legal distinction. It may have to do with the tax code or antitrust law. There may be some reason why we want to organize as a joint stock company, you know, take advantage of limited liability or whatever. It really doesn't have a substantive impact on what the firm does. It's just sort of a legal and tax issue. In the perspective that I outline in the chapter that I asked you to read, no, ownership is really, really important because ownership is the ability to make decisions about resources under conditions of uncertainty. And, as we talked about last week, under conditions of incomplete contracting, meaning we can't write arm's length agreements that will govern everything that we might possibly want to do. So what Foss and I do in this chapter is develop a notion of employees as proxy entrepreneurs. So our idea is, I mean, yeah, if ownership is associated with these, if ownership embodies these ultimate decision rights, then how do you explain how authority is delegated throughout a firm? And our idea is that, yes, the owners of the company, the owners of the assets, hold what we call original judgment authority by nature of ownership. But owners will typically choose to delegate authority to others within the organization, and we call this derived judgment. So, managers, employees, others who are assigned particular decision rights, under conditions of uncertainty, you know, it's like they're asked to play entrepreneur. Employees are sort of entrepreneurs acting as entrepreneurs on behalf of the owners, right? So the employee does not actually own the assets, does not bear the full residual decision authority associated with the asset, but the employee is asked by the owner to exercise judgment on the owner's behalf. You know, you make the decisions on a day-to-day basis about how best to deploy this asset under conditions of uncertainty. And what the entrepreneur wants is the employee to exercise these derived judgment rights in a way that creates value for the company, that is productive rather than destructive, right? So delegating authority to employees, asking them to act as if they were entrepreneurs, also gives them the ability to use this authority in a way that's harmful to the firm. So question of delegation from the point of view of the entrepreneur owning the firm is to manage this trade-off, right? To delegate in authority in a way that productive proxy entrepreneurship is encouraged while destructive proxy entrepreneurship is limited. So this is the sense in which the multi-level firm, the hierarchical firm, can be understood as a sort of a nested hierarchy of judgment, in which original judgment is held at the top, but derived judgment is delegated throughout the organization. And I'll just close with a quote from Ludwig Lachmann from his great book on capital theory. Lachmann outlines a theory of delegation that's quite similar to the one that Foss and I articulate in our book. He uses slightly different terminology. Lachmann refers to the capitalist entrepreneur and the manager entrepreneur. So what he means by the capitalist entrepreneur is the owner, right? What we call the entrepreneur exercising original judgment. What Lachmann calls the manager entrepreneur is the lower level employee who exercises derived judgment on the part of the owner, the so-called proxy entrepreneur. And Lachmann says the following: you know, the only significant difference between this capitalist entrepreneur and manager entrepreneur lies in that the specifying and modifying decisions of the manager presuppose and are consequent upon the decisions of the capitalist. Let me say that again. The specifying and modifying decisions of the manager presuppose and are consistent upon the decisions of the capitalist. In other words, the authority given to the manager to specify what should be done and to modify the production plan are sort of given to the manager by the owner, by the capitalist. So the capitalist sort of specifies the conditions under which the manager can exercise entrepreneurial judgment. Again, to go back to Lockman, if we like, we may say that the latter's decisions are of a higher order. So the capitalist, the entrepreneur, has sort of higher order authority. The employee exercising derived judgment has lower order authority, meaning simply that that authority is subordinate to the ultimate decision authority of the owner. Okay? So ownership has a lot to say about delegation. So I think I have some takeaways here on the very last slide. And here we go. You know, the allocation of decision rights has a strong effect on performance, current performance, current productivity, profitability, efficiency, and innovation. Right? And if I want to leave, you know, if you get only one message out of tonight's discussion, it's that decentralization has benefits but also costs. And don't go all Austrian on me and say, oh, well, Austrian economics teaches that decentralization is always best. No, it does not teach that. Right? Austrian economics teaches that there are benefits to delegation of authority in an organization but also costs. There still is some place for authority. And, you know, all forms of organization have benefits and costs. There's no optimal form of organization that you can read about in a book. The decision makers, the entrepreneurs, and those to whom they delegate authority have got to make these decisions on a case-by-case basis. Okay? Well, thanks for your patience. Let me look at the question log here a little bit and see if there are some specific questions that I can answer, problems that I can address. There's a good question from Bruce. Are there examples of organizational efforts to teach entrepreneurial alertness firm-wide as a strategy? I mean, I've talked to some managers, and I've had students in my own executive training seminars that I've led, you know, who have had gotten basically the same lecture that you've gotten. And one of the things we work on is how to get employees to exercise entrepreneurial ability, to exercise, you know, what I call proxy entrepreneurship, to exercise good judgment on the part of the owners, to be more alert to profit opportunities. And so, yeah, lots of companies who, you know, have read my book or have you know, gone through these exercises have tried to teach these principles explicitly to employees, right? I mean, I think in most cases, you know, giving the employees the decision rights and then giving them the appropriate incentive schemes, which we'll talk about next week, I mean, that's the best way to get employees to act entrepreneurially. Maybe they don't use this specific language. Maybe they don't need to read a book about it, right? But we just need to say, hey, we're going to allow you to do these things, and we're going to reward you for doing them in the right way. And I think most employees take to that in a very intuitive way. But there are lots of companies, you know, you guys know most of the names, right? Companies that do practice this more decentralized form of organization. And, you know, but not all companies do, right? It's not always the best scheme. It doesn't always work better than more directed kind of plans. Yeah, I mean, there's a point by Jason here that I think is a good one and that ties into this week's lecture and next. Jason says, I'm not going to exercise entrepreneurial attributes, unless I can benefit from doing so. Right. If I can't contribute to making changes, then I'm not going to bother. Right. This is another way of saying that organizational attributes kind of work best in clusters. So, you know, just you, the old saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. I mean, you can assign a decision right to an employee, but you can't make him or her exercise it if they don't want to. Right? So you've got to provide some incentives, namely letting the employee reap the benefits and suffer some of the harms from exercising those decision rights. Right? To put another way around, you can give employees strong pay for performance incentives. You know, we're not going to have any no base salary. We're only going to pay you know, piece rate bonuses, or we're going to pay you in stock options. We're going to give you strong performance incentives to make the firm perform better, but we're not going to give you any ability to do so, right? This is your job description. You do this, 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 and this exactly as we tell you. Well, that also doesn't make any sense, right? There's no point in providing performance incentives if the employee doesn't also have the ability to do things that will get the incentives. Just as it doesn't make sense to give people decision authority and then not give them any incentives to exercise that authority. So decentralization and pay for performance go together. If you are going to have a hierarchical form of organization, then pay for performance is not going to do much for you. In fact, it may do more harm than good. It makes the employees bear risk, but it doesn't motivate them to do anything because you're not letting them decide what to do in the first place. So organizational attributes go in bundles. Again, this week we focused on organizational structure. We focused on delegation of authority. Next week we're going to talk about pay for performance or compensation schemes more generally, and then we'll bring the two together and talk about which compensation schemes go with which models of decision rights assignment. Okay. A lot of good comments along this line. You know, stock option plans, that's one way of motivating employees. Cash bonuses, you know, can be another. Let's see. Yeah, Morningstar is another good example mentioned by Jared of a company that has a highly decentralized form of organization. I have to look up. I don't remember all the details about Morningstar, but that might be another one that we might want to check. Here's another question about organization of higher ed. This is a question from Jared. Would it be correct to say that colleges and universities and departments and colleges and research labs and departments, sorry, let me read this before I try to summarize it. Specialized knowledge and decentralization. I think this is a question about the organization of science. Science does tend to be organized in a fairly decentralized way, right? I mean, professors tend to have a lot of autonomy in how they teach their courses. Multidisciplinary science is, as Jared suggests, highly decentralized. Is that a good thing? Well, I mean, you know, look at you know, sort of the revolution in higher ed with MOOCs and University of Phoenix, you know, for-profit or institutions. You know, all established universities, if they hate the University of Phoenix and they hate MOOCs, and they're totally threatened by the for-profit model. And so what they do is they are constantly denouncing it, saying, oh, those University of Phoenix is not a real school, and they're not teaching real stuff. It's just a fly-by-night operation, blah, blah, blah. I mean, there are a lot of problems with those organizations, just with taking student loans and things. But the point here is that the University of Phoenix, it is more like an assembly line model. I mean, every accounting course, you know, any sort of financial accounting course, financial accounting 101, it's the same no matter when you take it and from whom you take it. It's very standardized. The professors are told what books to use and told how to teach and told what exams to give, like I was talking about before. That's a much more standardized model. And if you talk to some, you know, professors at Princeton, they're going to say, that's awful. It's terrible. No, higher education should never be like that. But, I mean, it may be that for some kinds of educational content, that model is actually much better. Maybe it's much more efficient. It doesn't cost as much. There are economies of scale. The content is pretty standardized. Maybe that is the best way to teach Accounting 101. Maybe that's not the best way to conduct a, you know, advanced seminar on literary theory. I don't know. maybe that's not the best way to teach students about black holes. But universities do tend to be pretty decentralized, but I would not claim that that's necessarily appropriate or efficient. That has to do with the tenure system. It has to do with state intervention in higher ed. I mean, it's not at all obvious that that's sort of the right way to do things. Now, the scientific enterprise itself tends to be fairly decentralized, right? I mean, you can't tell scientists exactly what experiments to perform because who would tell them? I mean, only the scientists themselves tend to know, and research labs tend to be organized pretty loosely. You know, the lab director is responsible for getting grants and getting funding and hiring postdocs and so forth, but pretty much stays out of the way, doesn't try to micromanage specific research projects. So that may be a context in which the benefits of decentralization, you know, tend to outweigh the costs pretty strongly. Okay, so lots of good comments about different examples of decentralization, when it seems to work, when it doesn't. Chris has a comment about, you know, well, but why do we have this system that the capital owners have the, you know, ultimate control rights? Is that sort of a function of contract law? I mean, I think my answer, Chris, is yes and no. I mean, yeah, of course, I mean, any kind of business organization is taking place within some kind of legal structure, some legal context. But I think that this notion of ownership, you know, having residual control rights, you have that under pretty much any kind of legal regime, whether it's a common law system or civil law system or whatever. I don't think that's an artificial or sort of arbitrary artifact of a particular legal system, though of course the details will vary from case to case. We talked about this a little bit last week. I don't think that, you know, limited liability is sort of plays a strong role in determining the particular corporate structure that we have. I think the details will vary depending on the specifics of the legal code, but this notion that ownership of an asset gives you ultimate control of that asset, I mean, that's really in any notion of ownership. And I think the kinds of ones that, you know, scholars like Rothbard and Hayek and others have written about, you know, they would all embrace some version of that ownership principle. So, okay, great discussion, but I think we need to draw it to a close. You all have access to the chat transcript, so please read it if you haven't been following along right now, and continue to post your excellent questions in the discussion forums, and let's continue to learn from each other. And let me know through the forums or through email if you have specific questions about anything that we've talked about tonight. Next week, again, remember, next week we're going to meet on Wednesday rather than Thursday. We'll send out email reminders to that effect. And next week we'll be talking about compensation and motivation. And then at the end we'll bring those two things together and I'll sort of do a little short inspirational wrap-up of the entire course. So thanks for being with us and see you guys soon.